My name's Jay Plumbeck. I'm an alcoholic. Through the grace of God and the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, working in my life a day at a time. I've been a member of Alcoholics Anonymous in good standing. That means I have not been drunk since March the 8th, 1974. I've been allowed to be an active member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm active in a home group. My home group is the Murrells Inlet Group in Murrells Inlet, South Carolina. That's a suburb of Myrtle Beach, which is better known as the Redneck Riviera. So if you're ever down in Myrtle Beach, you come to Murrells Inlet. And if you look in the phone book, I'm the only plumb back there. Don't say I'm an alcoholic. It just says I live there, and there's a number there. Which makes me curious. You know, I've been reading. I know I heard Smitty last night. I really appreciated all the speakers, and I've had a good time here. I'm not going to repeat what they said. If you weren't here to hear it, buy the tape. If you don't buy the tape, somebody's going to ask you about what they said, and you won't know. But if you buy the tape, you'll know, because they were all good speakers, and you need to hear what they say. But Smitty had talked about the beginnings, and I remember reading some stuff that his daddy wrote, Dr. Bob. And Dr. Bob made a statement. And he said, in Alcoholics Anonymous, there is no anonymity. We are anonymous at the level of press, radio, and film. But in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, we are not anonymous. Now, that's what he said, and I sort of like it. Not because I want you to know me, but I want to know you. Because when my butt's falling off and I'm in Jackson, Mississippi, it's going to be hell to call Dan A. You come to Myrtle Beach and say, I want to see J.P. First, they'll think you're perverted. And by the time you've explained it, you don't know what, he might be drunk. So anyhow, that's just something I just, you know, think about and think about what they did in the beginning. And it's important to me. You do whatever you want to do. But I really do want to know who you are so that if I need to call somebody, I know who I can call. I didn't plan on being an alcoholic. I never planned on being here on August the 12th of the year 2000. I wanted to be a lot of other things. I wanted to be as far back as I can remember. And I'm a little more nervous than usual tonight talking. Usually every time I come to talk somewhere, since I've been a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, since the first year I was sober when I was asked to talk, my wife would tell me just before I'd leave the house or if I'd be somewhere, she'd call me. And the last thing she'd say is tell the truth and do a good job. I buried my wife on July 23rd this year. And she didn't call me today, but I've had a number of people tell me to do a good job and not to tell a lie. But I miss her telling me that. And I miss her. And you'll hear about her in my story because, after all, she was a part of my life for 35 years. How could you not hear about her? I didn't plan on being an alcoholic, I told you that, and certainly didn't plan on being a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I could be like some of the people I hear come around here and say, you know, I've been around AA a long time. I've been around AA, as a matter of fact, since 1943. I was born in Parma. That's a suburb of Cleveland, 35 miles from Akron. So that's being around AA. But ain't got a damn thing to do with me standing here. But I was just like you, I guess, growing up. I was normal. I thought I was normal anyhow. I was mad. I didn't know I was mad. I thought I was normal. Hell, I didn't know I was mad till I was sober a year and a half. Now, wasn't it I was a slow learner? I just had no idea what mad was. I knew what normal was, and that was me. I was at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous a year and a half sober at the Nuestra Esperanza Group in West Palm Beach, Florida. It was a big book study meeting. I love big book meetings. And that meeting, I'd been over to a big book meeting across town the day before, and they'd studied what we were studying in our group that night, and I'd listened to what some wise people said, and I repeated it as though it was original in my group. And they knew about it because they knew about me. You see, that first year and a half, I was active in Alcoholics Anonymous. I was everything. I was sort of a poster child of AA. I cleaned ashtrays and washed coffee cups and set up the meeting rooms and chaired when they let me. And I did everything in that group. I had just got elected intergroup rep for God. I was everything except treasurer. I still ain't been treasurer. I don't know about it. But anyhow, I was in that group and I spouted some kind of wisdom. I'd heard somebody else saying after the meeting that night, there's a man took me aside. His name was John. And John was sober a year or two longer than me, and he put his arm around my shoulder, and he told me that he loved me. And he told me that I was a phony and that I was about to get drunk. And God, I hated him. If he'd have been a little bit smaller, I'd have hit him. But he carried me home with him that night, and he lived in Loxahatchee, Florida. It was a little swamp place outside of West Palm Beach, and he set me down on the stoop of his trailer. Well, pardon me, on the stoop of his manufactured home. Y'all need to understand, back when I had my 3,400 square foot house on a golf course, those were trailers. But now that I have one, they have become manufactured homes. Perspective is everywhere you are, I reckon. But anyhow, he carried me back to the trailer, set me down on the stoop of it, and he began to talk to me about Alcoholics Anonymous. And he talked to me about the first step. And in the first step, you know, where we're powerless over alcohol and our lives become unmanageable, I thought I'd accepted that premise. And he told me I was wrong. I never had, and I really never had. All I've known from the very beginning was that my drinking was different, that I was powerless over alcohol. I'd accepted what it said in the book about my alcoholic my drinking being different from that of a normal drinker. I knew that something happened with that when I drank that didn't happen when you drank or when they drank. So I knew that was wrong, but I never went any further than that. And when that was all the information I had and I tried to do the remaining steps, I was sort of in a bad place. I couldn't go any further. I had nothing to go to. But John talked to me that night about step one. And he said, after we talk about our being powerless over alcohol, we talk about our lives becoming unmanageable. And he talked to me about the unmanageability of my life. I'll tell you what my life was like a year and a half sober. I'd gone back to sea. And I was in trouble. When I'd gone back to sea, I was in a country called Sri Lanka. It's an island country off the coast of India, and I'd been there for about 35 days, and I went to an AA meeting every single day I was there, and I met some other AAers there, and we went into a business. It was the import and export business. And we was exporting from there and importing into here. We called it import-export. The government called it smuggling. There's... Again, it's all perspective. They had laws, and we disobeyed them. Now, it wasn't drugs. It was semi-precious gemstones. Now, as a marine engineer, I didn't know a damn thing about gemstones or jewelry, but I knew I could make some money, and I knew I was smarter than them. I'd be able to do it. So I was in trouble with the laws, on the verge of going to jail. I was in trouble in my job in a merchant marine. I was in trouble with my family, sober a year and a half, doing what I could do in Alcoholics Anonymous, and all I was doing was not drinking. My family life went to hell. It was so bad that I was sleeping in the big bed, and she was sleeping in the other room. I was going to sex without partners, for Christ's sake. A little self-help group down there. I was in trouble in every single area of my life, and I was on the verge of taking a drink. And John said, that's unmanageability, step one. I can't. So he made it real simple for me. And he said, step two, he said, come to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. You know, I'd been hearing about sanity. You know, I'd go into meetings where a lot of people came with a lot more knowledge and intelligence than I. And they'd talk about sanity, and I equated that with bizarre behavior. I've always had bizarre behavior. I still have bizarre behavior. But he said, that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about the insanity that precedes the first drink. That's that thought that comes into my mind that says, this time I can take a drink and I can control it. This time I can take a drink and I won't do what I did before. I won't act the way I did before. This time I'll take a drink and everything will be all right. That's that strange insanity that precedes the first drink. He said, and that's all step two is equated with in our book. And it made sense to me. And Bill, as I look at the book and I study what it says that. And it reiterates it in a different way after the promises. We always read the promises, but at the very end of it, it says, if tempted, we react. If tempted by alcohol, we react as if from a hot flame, for sanity has returned. And John said, for me, that means sanity would simply mean that taking a drink would not become an acceptable alternative. It's always laid there. You know, if I told you I didn't think about a drink from the time I got here until today, that'd be a lie. So thinking about a drink doesn't mean you took one. It just means you thought of it. When you think of it and you react with sanity, it means you react by backing away, saying, not for me. And he said, that's the sanity we'll talk about. Step two, he can, that a power could give me that back. He said, armed with that information, we'll make a decision. You'll either decide to go ahead and do something or you're going to decide not to. And if you decide to do something, we'll pray the prayer in the book. And that's simple. Like within a half hour from going to his trailer, I'm on my knees and I'm praying the prayer in our book. And we read the prayer out of the book, just like it was in the book. You know, and I've memorized volumes of stuff in my life, but I've not memorized that prayer. I can't repeat it to you verbatim. And yet I pray that prayer every morning. I have it typed out on a little card, and I just read it out every morning. Sometimes I can do it with more meaning than others. And that day I was able to do it with some meaning. I was making a decision to do whatever was necessary to allow God to give me the power to do what I needed to do. And that's all that decision was. Once I got off my knees, the decision was out of my hands for a moment. John handed me a yellow legal tablet. And he said in the upper left-hand corner, there was three columns on one side, and on the other side it was blank. So he said, on the upper left-hand column, I want you to write the word down, I resent. I said, John, I don't resent anybody. He said, put down, I hate. Hell, I hated everybody. That wasn't a problem. He helped me out. He told me who to put down first. He said, put down the name Siraj. Now, Siraj doesn't mean anything to you. It meant something to me. It was that Indian that was living in my house. Now, he wasn't an American Indian. He was an Indian Indian. And I hated him. I hated him a lot. I hated him because he had all my money, or they had all my money, and I was broke. I was going bankrupt. You know, I hated him because he is eating raw meat and we're eating beans. I hated him because he is sleeping in a bed and my little boy was sleeping on the floor. I hated him because he wore a dress. Now, they didn't call it a dress. They called it a sari. But damn if it didn't look like a dress to me. And when I put down I hated him, why I hated him, I knew that I hated him. And you see, that part of the inventory is the most natural thing in the world for a guy like me. I hear people in AA say, I'm afraid of an inventory. Well, hell, I was too until I found out what it was. When I found out what it was, I ain't afraid no more. I was just going to keep on doing what I'd always been doing, that is, talking about you. I know when it's ready to take another inventory, when I'm talking about you a lot. If I'm fine, hell, then it's time to go on. Because that's the first column of the inventory. Put down who you hate and why you hate them. What'd they do to you? It said real or imagined. I went back through my life from Siraj all the way on back, and I found that I hated damn near everybody I'd ever met. Everybody had wronged me. And I put down why they'd wronged me and how they had wronged me. You know? So I was mad as far back as I can remember. I had some other things wrong with me as a little kid. I was a liar. And I never did think I was a liar. I thought I had a gift. I thought it was just... I thought God had gifted me with this ability to say something, and it'd be true just because I said it. Now, my voice is deeper than my size. So people will call me, they'll say, how tall are you? I'll say 6 foot, and they'll believe me, for Christ's sake. I can't step out of my shadow, but I could tell a lie and I'd believe it. I could tell you I was smart and I'd believe that, or I'd tell you I did well in school. Whatever I told you, I believed. And if you didn't believe it, I got mad at you. And when you can lie like that, if you're like me, I set myself up for the biggest lie I ever told, the one that almost killed me, the lie that I touched on earlier, the lie that this time I'll take a drink and it'll be all right. This time I'll take a drink and I'll control it. This time I'll take a drink and I won't hurt you. And I told that lie and I believed it, and that almost killed me. And I was a thief as far back as I can remember. Now, I don't really look like a thief, and I didn't look like one then. I just thought I was a short, fat Robin Hood, I guess. I might go around and steal something from Gordon, and I give it to James. I never thought about the fact that Gordon worked a lot of hours to buy whatever the hell it was I stole. I thought about the fact if I gave it to James, he'd say he's a nice guy and I want him around. Now, if I was talking to one of them counselors or social workers or something, they'd say I was trying to buy somebody's affection or buy their... Hell, I didn't know I was doing that. I was just doing that. And nobody taught me that. It just came natural. And I think all this stuff that was coming natural is a part of alcoholism. Yet it didn't make me an alcoholic. It made me a screwed-up, mad, lying, stealing kid. Hell, I ain't even started school yet. Now, with all that, I couldn't come to AA. But I still was around AA. Yeah, I lived there near Akron. And then I went off to the first grade, and the first grade was a hell of an experience. I went to a parochial school. Now, I know here I'm right here in the navel of the Southern Baptist Bible Belt, but up there, a parochial school meant Catholic. And I went there, and I had a nun. Her name was Sister Lucy. Sister Lucy was sort of early S&M. She wore a black robe. It went all the way down. She had a white deal on the front, and she had leather and chains on her that clanked when she walked. Now, I'll tell you, she brought fear into hearts of me. I'll guarantee you that now. And halfway through the first grade, she called my parents in and wanted to see them, said I'd done something terrible. I didn't know what it was. Got my parents in there, and I'm out in the hall like I wasn't supposed to hear, and I was eavesdropping, always was nosy, you know. I just hearing what they said. And she told my parents that it appeared as though I was a very gifted child, that I'd look at something, I'd remember it, and I understood things easily, and that with what the talents that God seemed to have given me, I could go anywhere or do anything. And as soon as I heard her tell them that, my education stopped immediately. Once I knew how smart I was, it was hard to find someone smarter than me. I mean, I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. I was surrounded by dummies. They didn't know a damn thing. I couldn't learn nothing. It took me a year and a half to be able to hear somebody, and then I found out how dumb I was and how smart they were. But there I was in the first grade, knowing how smart I was and lying and stealing and all this other stuff and not feeling like I belonged to that family. I never thought my mom and dad loved me. You know, I never had any kind of relationship with my daddy. He was a drinker. He drank all the time, far back as I can remember. I never saw him drunk, but he drank morning, noon, and night. He was a big shot in Cleveland, where we live, that suburb of Cleveland, Ohio. His picture was on the back of buses. He was a big news analyst at a coast-to-coast hookup and had changed his name word working that business and that media, and it was just a big deal. And I never felt I had a daddy. I just felt he was there. I never felt my mother loved me. I never felt her hug me or kiss me or tell me that she loved me. I'm sure that she did. I have a sister a year older, a sister a year younger, another sister 5 years younger, a baby brother 18 years younger than I. And I've seen all my siblings get physical and emotional love and attention. So I'm sure that I did. But I don't remember it. I don't remember feeling it. And I think that's a part of alcoholism, that bar that was inside of me. And that's the way I was in the first grade, and I started getting in trouble. They started calling me before the class. By the time I was in the third grade, I was in all kinds of trouble. I was still getting straight A's just so I could remember whatever I looked at, but I was just in trouble everywhere, and I didn't want it to be that way. And I wound up in front of a juvenile referee, and he labeled me incorrigible. Now, I didn't know what that meant. I had a very lousy vocabulary. When you're as smart as I am, you don't learn very fast. But I looked her up one day and figured it out. It was a multi-syllable word that meant punk. What I was just a punk. And they sent me off to this orphanage. It was a funny thing about this orphanage. There wasn't no orphans there. They were just all punks like me. And what I was there for was to get straightened out so that I could become decent and do right in the world. And that's all they wanted from me, but I didn't know it. I thought they were punishing me. I didn't know they wanted to help guide me and correct me. And I got out of there after a couple of years, and things kept getting worse, and I wanted it to be better. And then one day, I went back to another reformatory and came out back to another. And at 13 years old, I was out on the street one more time. And I decided to take a drink. Now, I'm sure that prior to age 13, like a couple of the other speakers said, I'm sure I'd had alcohol in me many, many times. In that environment, the way my daddy drank, and my mama was a regular drinker, and the way the family drank, they always got together with these family deals two or three times a year, and they get kegs of beer and kegs of wine and bottles of liquor and just everything, and whatever the adults had, the kids had. We'd get a little bit of what they had, and we'd steal some more. And I don't remember any of that. I just remember there were times of it, but it did nothing to me or for me. So I'm sure that would have been identified as my social drinking, because social drinkers drink just that way. It don't do a damn thing for them or to them, and they don't remember much about it. They just did it, didn't do it, they ain't sure. And that's how I was till 13. I just did whatever was around. But at 13, I made a conscious decision to drink. And in Ohio, you had to be 21. I didn't look 13. I had not cultivated my first zit yet, for God's sakes. So I had to give myself a little age. So I went to my mother's purse and stole some money. That's the best place to steal it from. It was closest. And then I got me an eyebrow pencil and sort of give myself a beard and a mustache. Now, Phil was kind enough to pick me up at the airport, and we've had a real good time. And, you know, let me tell you, I can assure you my beard and mustache look nothing at all like his. You know, I just look like a 13-year-old punk going down on Skid Row with a bunch of blackheads dotted on, sort of running, you know. And I went down to a Skid Row to get this to drink. Me and this guy, I got to go with me, and I remember going in some joints. Remember what we ordered? We ordered two bottles of mixed screwdrivers and two bottles of Thunderbird wine. I remember like it was yesterday. And I don't know why we had ordered those particular concoctions. I can guess at it, though. Screwdrivers, because it sounded sort of sexy. It had a ring to it, a sexy ring, you know, and promised something at the end of it, I guess. Didn't know you had to have a partner, I told you. And Thunderbird, because of the stuff I saw. There used to be a billboard on 25th Street down near Scranton, and it had a huge billboard, and on it there was this bird, and it was just soaring through the air. And I remember the words I'd heard in the place I'd been locked up in, you know. What's the word? Thunderbird. You know, I'll tell you, fly that through you, brother. It'll fire you up. You try to do it with Mogan David, ain't gonna do a damn thing. So I was attracted to it. Also, the price was real attractive. You know, to this day, I notice they still keep Thunderbird in the same place in the stores, in the liquor stores. It's on the bottom shelf. They don't care if you steal it. It's when they say how much alcohol by volume, I mean, they're just being a guesswork. You know, they don't know what the hell's in there. It ain't nothing fermented, I'll guarantee you that. But anyhow, we got those four bottles and went out behind that place, went behind some bushes. You know, you don't have to be a certain age to drink if you want to drink. You go to enough of them joints and you'll find the right place and give you the right stuff. Went behind some bushes. We started to drink, whichever one it was we started to drink. Don't know which one it was. Don't remember exactly what happened after we started. But I know what happened in the long term. I know I woke up the next morning in a way that I was going to wake up in over and over again until I got to you people. I woke up in a mess, and it was mine. I woke up with a new fear about me. I say a new fear because when I was doing that inventory I started off telling you about a little earlier, you know, I had that column down there about who I hated and why I hated them. That was the easy part. My sponsor made me go to another column and said, put down how it affected you. I'll tell you that first guy who told you about what he had done to me, how it affected me. It affected my security because I was going bankrupt. It affected my self-esteem because I knew I wasn't doing what I should be doing as a husband and a father. It affected my sex life. I told you about that. It affected every area of my life. And underneath it all was fear. And I went through that whole list and had to identify that with each and every one of those resentments. And then my sponsor said, we're going to go back to that list one more time. And now we're going to put out of our mind the wrongs they have done, real or imagined. We're going to put them out of our mind. If they are real, we're going to pray for them as if they're a sick person. And we're going to look for our part in the wrong. And I said, John, how could I possibly have been wrong? I had money and now I've got none. You know, I had a lot of things going and it's all gone. What could I have done? And he said, well, just pray about it. He said, you ask God to help you. He said, and he just might help you find just some small little area you might have been able to do something a little different in. I told you I was a marine engineer. That meant I ran ships. I was in charge of them. The engine rooms on them. I didn't know a damn thing about gemology. Gem mines or nothing like that, international business. And I went into business with these guys. And the reason I went into business with them is because I thought they had a lot of money through some factors in Germany. And I thought I could get their money because they're very wealthy where they lived. And I thought I could tap into that and I could get their money. And by going at them that way and trying to get their money, I brought this guy over here on a visa because that was the condition. They wanted a watchdog here to watch me. I had him over here, and because of the laws we broke, he would never see his family again. To this day, he can't go back to that country. He'll go to jail for a long, long time. Their laws are different than ours. And I saw my part in it. I saw what I had done. And as soon as I saw what I had done to him and why I had done it and put it on paper where I had to look at it, my hate for him left. What I thought he had done to me meant absolutely nothing. Did that mean I loved him? No. Does it mean I want to stay with him today? No. But it showed me what my part in the wrong had been, and the hatred went away. And once the hatred went away, I saw what I had to do to make it right. I was going to have to go to him later with this list and talk to him about my part in the wrong and ask him what I could do to make it right and make it right. That was going to be closure for it. But anyhow, when I got through that inventory, I had to go through that whole list of resentments and find my part in the wrong. And I can only report to you what happened to me. There was not a single one of them where I was not able to find something I could not have done differently. I could not have added to it or not done that would have made it better. And as soon as I had that down on paper, the hatred and the anger I felt for the other person or the institution went away. And that's a freedom that you'll only know if you do it that way. If you try and do it another way, a life story just doesn't get it out that way for me because I can't see exactly what I have done. And I got to see what I have done. Anyway, I got through with that part of the inventory, and my sponsor had me list my fears. And I wrote them down. I wrote down that I was afraid of heights, and I was afraid of a lot of things. I was afraid she was leaving. Hell, a few lines later, I was afraid she wasn't leaving. It was the same she. It was just different times of the day. I screwed up. But he had all my fears down, and he said, put them down no matter how foolish you feel about them. And I put them down. He said, when they were all down there, he said, now we ask God to take them away. And I got on my knees, and I asked God to take them away, and I felt no difference, I felt no change. And I told John that, and I told him I still felt full of fear. And he said, what are you afraid of? And I couldn't explain it. And he said, Jay, he said, let's open up the book. We did it in Bill's story. Bill talks about that fear of impending calamity. And those are fancy words that mean the fear that John explained to me, the fear that something bad was going to happen and I couldn't stop it. He told me that fear would show itself when an envelope came and I couldn't see what was in it and didn't want to open it, or knock on a door and I didn't want to answer the door. Hey, you can spot that fear every time you make a 12-step call. Guy can't pay his light bill, ain't paid child support if he's got children, ain't got a car, don't have a job, but by God, he's got a phone with caller ID. I know that fear. And that fear began back when I was about 13. And I see how that fear grew in my life over the years until it almost killed me. By the time I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, my only escape from that fear was when I was in a total blackout, just completely unconscious. Anytime I was awake, it was there. And I know that had I not found you and found an alternative way to live, I would not have been able to live today. I'd had to kill myself. I could not have lived with that fear any longer. Once John talked to me about it, we got on our knees and I asked God to remove it, and it's been gone from that day to this. Not without coming back occasionally. You know, we were talking about that in a meeting the other day. You see, God took that fear away right then. But he gives me a wake-up call periodically. When I'm not doing things I ought to do, or I am doing things I shouldn't ought to do, I start to get that fear. And that's that gut deal down here where it don't go away and you feel bad and you're afraid. When I see it coming there, and then I got to look at my life right then and see, what do I got to do differently? What do I have to change? And then I ask God to take it, and it'll be gone again. And when my humanness shows again, I have the same process to be able to go through. But that fear started back in my early teen years. And long as I was talking about an inventory, I'm going to finish up about one other thing, and that's the sex part of it. And the sex part of it covers far more pages than resentment and fear. And I like the way it starts off. If you ain't read it, you know, you ought to read it. It really is good. It says, now about sex. We all have problems there. There's something about that word all that I like. There ain't many people can get around all. We'd hardly be human if we didn't. And I said, what do we do about it? It don't say talk to your sponsor and have him or her tell you how to live. It don't say don't have relationships for a year. It don't say get into a relationship. It says go over your conduct, see what you need to do. Counsel with others is helpful. Avoid hysterical comments. Shape a sane ideal. And who do you shape it with? God. He asked God to help you, and I asked God to help me that day when I was doing that. And I wrote it down on paper, and I talked to my sponsor about it. My sponsor, who did not judge me as to what I should or shouldn't do, because it's between me and God, and I put an ideal down that I tried to live to. Now, I told you, I'm sober a little over 26 years, and I was sober a year and a half when I did that for the very first time. And over the ensuing almost 25 years, that standard has changed. And it has to change. If I'm going to continue to grow, as Bill says it, in the sunlight of the Spirit, then the standard that was sufficient a quarter of a century ago couldn't possibly be sufficient today. You know, I've got to be willing to change and improve the way I live, or else I ain't got much of a chance. It says, what happens if you fall short of that ideal? Will you get drunk? Well, not entirely so. It says, what was your motive? What was your motive? And if we keep trying to do the right thing, we'll be all right. But we don't hurt other people. And then he's got a phrase in there that I really like. It says, tells me what to do. When that thing's driving you nuts, work with a drunk. That'll quiet that imperious urge. I love that imperious urge. God, he makes it sound great. But it'll quiet that urge when nothing else will work. So I'm sure tonight, instead of being at the dance, everybody will be over to 12 Step House. Don't, if you have not taken an inventory the way it's laid out in the book, please don't cheat yourself. Do it. Because if we short ourselves, we wind up drunk. And if we wind up drunk, we wind up dead. We have no guarantee that we'll never get another opportunity to not drink a day at a time. But anyhow, there I was at 13 years old and coming off my first drunk, and I didn't want it to be that way. And you know, I found something that first night that it was so fantastic, I didn't know it was that good. But that was what turned into alcoholism for me. See, up until that point, social drinking was just drinking and not really having any impact. But that particular night, I crossed over that line, whatever that line is, but it's written out in our book, where it says on page 21, what about the real alcoholic? Another great phrase, sort of like all, you can't get around it. What about the real alcoholic? He or she is that individual who may or may not be a heavy drinker, may or may not be a daily drinker, but at some stage of his drinking career begins to lose all control once he starts to drink. That was me at 13. Once I took a drink, I didn't know how much I'd have. That didn't change from then till now. The only thing that changed was how much and how long. But I never knew. If I took a drink today, I don't know what had happened. I only know but what I've seen, and it wouldn't be good. So what happened between 13 and 30 and a half, it just got worse. And I didn't want it to be that way. I had a period of sobriety from 13 to 13 and a half to 17 and a half. Not because I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, even though I was still around it, but because I'd broken some laws, and they locked me up on an indefinite sentence, and I went away to a reformatory for almost 4 years. And I got out of there at 17 and a half years old, not because I was had served my sentence, but because I ran away. And I went down on the skid row and got a guy to sign me into the service as though he was my father. And I went away to Navy boot camp. And the very first place the law went when I had run away from there was to my parents' house. And I didn't know that. But they went there because they wanted me back because I was an escaped criminal. And my parents went to the juvenile authorities, and through a lot of scrambling around, they got the courts to allow me to stay in the Navy in the hopes that I'd become a productive citizen. They would have had to turn me loose at 18 anyhow, and they said, now there'd be some kind of control over me till I was 21. Now, I didn't know that these people were trying to help me. Had I known what had gone on, I'd have got mad. I'd have thought they were meddling in my life, because I always wanted to do it my way, and if you interfered, it wasn't doing it my way, and I didn't like it. And I couldn't tell you about what was going on in my life, because there was something else that went on in my head, and that was the thing that you didn't understand. No matter what went on, I knew you wouldn't understand, so I couldn't talk to you about it. People would say, why don't you talk to me? Social workers and psychiatrists and psychologists, they'd all say, why don't you tell me? How the hell could I tell you? I just knew you didn't understand. You never lived the way I lived. You never felt the way I felt. How the hell could you understand? So that was in my head. So I went off to the Navy. I remember got out of boot camp, at the end of boot camp, I wrote my parents and I told them where I was and told them that I loved them and I was going to live a different life now and I'd make them proud of me. And my mom and dad rode a Greyhound bus to Chicago and they watched the graduation ceremony at Great Lakes Naval Training Center and they carried me into Chicago on a 12-hour pass. Going into a restaurant with my mom and dad, and I just remember going in with them. I knew I had this good feeling. I was going to be a son to them now, and I was going to have a daddy I'd never had in my life. And we sat down at a table, and my dad said, what would you like to drink, son? He said, I know you're not old enough to drink, but if you're old enough to be in the service, I'll buy you whatever you want. What do you have? And I said, I'll have a beer. And I started to get that warm feeling you get inside when you know you and your dad are going to be buddies. And he ordered me a beer, and he ordered himself a cup of coffee, and he ordered my mother a Coca-Cola. And I looked at him, because I didn't understand this. He always drank. I never knew him not to drink. And I said, what's the matter? Aren't you drinking? And my mother, she had that funny look in her eyes some of these women get sometimes. She said, no, she said, your daddy doesn't drink anymore. He's a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. He's been sober for 3 months or 4 months. It was a long, long time, I know that. Let me tell you about my daddy. He got sober in Cleveland in late 1959. And what had happened was the guy that was his sponsor checked him into a place called Rosary Hall. Rosary Hall was a drying-out joint run by Sister Ignatia. And Sister Ignatia is written about throughout our history. And all it was a 3 to 5 day detox. And it was for men only. And the only thing in there to read was a big book of 12 and 12 and grapevines. This is what I've heard since then. There was no TVs or radios. The only way you got is your sponsor checked you in. The only way you got out is when she discharged you into the care of your sponsor. You had no family visits. There was no family counseling. There was nothing. All it was dry you out. And they dried you out with that green lizard they were talking about. Peraldehyde. If you've had it, you know it's green lizard. And it's good stuff. It'll get you there in a hurry. But they dried them out with green lizard and with liquor. And they give you a little bit of liquor and a little bit of peraldehyde and bring them right on off of it. And when they got off of it, they discharged them. My daddy laid in straps for 5 days and almost died. And when they discharged him, Sister Ignatia gave him a little Sacred Heart thing and a little brass thing and discharged him to care of his sponsor and said, if you go with your sponsor, Jim, to Alcoholics Anonymous and listen to what they tell you to do, you'll never have to come off another drunk. My daddy went with you people and did exactly what you told him to do, and he did not drink from that day until the day he died, or through the day he died in 1981. He stayed sober in AA. My dad showed unconditional love to me in that bar restaurant that day. He offered to buy me a drink. He didn't say, well, you know, he shouldn't or whatever. He offered to buy me a drink. But did I see it as unconditional love? This kid that wants to be a loving son? Nah. I'll tell you what I saw it as. I couldn't understand why he didn't like me. I knew he wasn't drinking just to make me mad. And I looked at my watch, and I wondered how soon can I get away from these people and meet my friends and do some drinking. And I went out that night, and I drank. And I woke up the next morning the same way I woke in the last time I drank. The same mess, the same fear, and the same not remembering where I'd been. And it kept getting worse. My career in the Navy didn't take long. They threw me out. Just 1 day short of 6 months after I got in, they threw me out. They did not give me an intervention. Oh, yes, they did. They locked me up. But they didn't. They did not offer me treatment. What they said is, you're out of here, or we're going to court-martial you. So I got out of there, and I went back to my parents' house for what was to be the very last time. And this was on my 18th birthday, and I bought an old Studebaker. Most of y'all don't even know what a Studebaker is. It's an old car, I'll tell you that. But I got an old rusted up Studebaker, and I went out to celebrate, got my first driver's license. Went out to celebrate my 18th birthday, and I stopped at a bar called Angelo's. And I went in there and I started drinking, and I woke up the next morning the same way I woke up every time I drank by then. I woke up in a mess, and I woke up with a new fear. And I looked around and I did not recognize my environment. It was the very first time I woke up in a jail like that. And I didn't know what I'd done. And they told me what I'd done. I had 8 traffic violations. They had me for hit skip. They had me for driving. I had a license, but I didn't have insurance. And I had a couple of hitting cars and driving away from them. And they had me for assaulting an officer. And they always want to throw that one in when you can't remember. It's assaulting. Now, if you remember, they won't do it. But I had a reputation. I always had a reputation as a fighter. I never did have a reputation as a winner. I sort of became a human punching bag. So I had all these tickets, and they let me out of jail, and I didn't put up any bail. And the reason I did is my mama was clerk of courts in that small town. And I went back to her house. And as I walked in, my sister was there. My sister was a year younger than me, and she had joined the Ursuline Convent. She's a novitiate, what they call a novitiate, but now she's in. She was sitting there with my mother, and my mother was crying. And I remember looking at my mother, and I said, "What's wrong with you? Why are you crying? I'm the one that's been in jail." And my mom looked at me, and she said, "I'm pregnant." She said, "And I'm just praying that this child inside of me will either abort naturally or that it'll be a girl, because I don't want another child like you." How many times have I said, "My drinking doesn't bother nobody but me"? All I got to do is look around. That's all I got to do. And my alcoholism progressed. They told me I was a lousy sailor, threw me out of there. I had a driver's license, lost that the very first day. Just to report to you, I did not get a legal driver's license back again until I was sober in Alcoholics Anonymous almost 3 years. Now, I never did quit driving, but they didn't have the computers they have today. I just go somewhere, get another license. They kid up with me, lock me up. I get another one somewhere else. I started going to sea, and in between ships, I drove. So I just, wherever I got off a ship, I get a license. Oregon, Texas, California, I didn't care. And I get jobs when I was ashore. I got a job I was driving an ambulance one time down in Florida. And they arrested me for drunk driving and hit skip. And I didn't understand. I'm trying to save lives, and I'm getting in trouble. And so when they told me I was a lousy sailor, I did what they said, "Well, you'd probably do this." So I was no good going to sea, so I joined a merchant marine. A merchant marine is a civilian way of going to sea, and I went to sea from then until the mid-80s when I had an injury that took me out of it. And I liked going to sea because I made an awful lot of money. They didn't pay you a lot an hour, but you worked a lot of hours. There wasn't nowhere to spend it when you was on a ship. And they only give you 10% of it when you was overseas somewhere, so you had a bunch when you got off. And they give it to you in $100 bills, and you get off, you could be a big shot. I got on my first ship. We went to Japan. I went ashore, and they got me 3 days later, brought me back and fired me. They logged me. Logging is what they do on a ship, a disciplinary action. The captain gets you in front of them, and he puts you in the log book and says he fires you. And I was concerned, and the rest of the guys said, "Don't worry about it. We all get off the ship at the end of the voyage. Most of us get fired, and those of us don't just quit. We just get another ship." And they explained to me, we had 300 ships under union agreement. Each one of them was a separate entity. Each ship was 3 or 4 months long. Well, I did the math. Let me see, 4 times 300, 1,200, divided by, I ain't going to live 100 years. I couldn't possibly run out of ships. My education stopped in the 8th grade, but my thinking didn't. So I knew I had a position for life. I didn't know that there were some other things that come into play that had changed that. But I started getting in trouble immediately, and I didn't want it that way, so I put rules in my drinking, and for a while I could live with rules in my drinking. I wouldn't drink when I was on a ship, or I wouldn't drink here. And when I could do that, I didn't get in trouble until I did take the first drink. You see, when there were periods of sobriety, it made it harder and harder for me to identify the alcoholism. The periods of sobriety made me think that I wasn't that bad because I didn't have what I'd see other people I thought had. But the nature of alcoholism doesn't mean you drink every day. It means when you drink, you don't know what's going to happen. And I had that allergy of the body. And I had that coupled with that obsession of the mind saying, this time it's going to be different. The only way it ever got different was worse. But all I ever thought about it, get better. But there was nothing to prove it'd get better, but it always got worse. Alcoholics like me got to be nuts. So I'm getting in trouble and things are getting worse. And I said, well, I'll get a license in the merchant marine. I'll become an officer. That'll impress everybody. So I did. I studied. I got a license. I had the same thing college graduates got. And things kept getting worse. I said, I'll get married. Things will get better. Everybody knows that married people with families get along great. You never have problems. You know, so I was sitting in a bar one day shopping for a wife, and she walked in. She sat right down next to me, just a little bitty old redhead, and God, if you thought I was mad, she's madder. I looked over at her. I said, can I buy you a drink? She said, no, I don't drink. That was true love. I couldn't afford another drinker. I knew it. I mean, I give you guys that marry drinkers a lot of credit. I had better sense. I just knew how much I was going to spend on me. So anyhow, I got out all them $100 bills. I managed to find out why she was so mad. She didn't drink because she didn't believe in drinking. And she was mad because she was in a very abusive marriage. She had a baby a few months old, another baby 4 years old, and a husband that had abused her badly, and she was gone and was never going back. She hated men and she hated life. That was a challenge. I hauled out all them $100 bills I had because I just got off a ship, sort of spread them out in front of her so she could see them. She's brokered me. And I began to lie and she began to listen. And now we heard about that 17-year courtship last night. Well, I began to court her. And after a lengthy courtship, we got married. Now, if you were to be able to ask her today how long that was, she would tell you about 10 minutes. I personally think it was about 20 minutes. Those of you who be real alcoholic understand that. We do not rush into heavy decisions. We take our time. 10 minutes is just a little too abrupt for something that lasting. But anyhow, I scared hell out of her, and she took off, and I found her in Florida a couple months later, and I went through the whole same deal, and anyhow, to make a long story short, she got divorced on October 14th, 1966, and we got married on October 15th, 1966. And I wanted to be a good husband. I'd had role models as husbands. My grandparents, they would have married each other all their lives. My daddy and my mom, they stayed married. My uncles. There were very few cases of divorce in and around my acquaintances. So I had role models, and I knew when you got married, you were committed. And I didn't know what committed was, but I was going to be that. And I was going to be the daddy that my daddy had never been. So I knew that him not being a daddy didn't mean that he wasn't married. It's just he wasn't. I was going to be a daddy. He wasn't, but I would be. And I had a little boy coming in this marriage, Ricky. He was 6 years old. He was hanging onto my legs the day we're getting married. He looked up at me and he said, please be my daddy. And as he said that, I knew how much I needed to be his daddy because I knew how little I had had a daddy and how much I'd wanted one. I remember holding little Kim in my arms and I was going to be her daddy. I was going to be all the things to her that a daddy's got to be. And this woman I was marrying, Yvonne, I was going to be a husband to her. I was going to be faithful. I was going to support her. I was going to give her financial security. I was going to be kind and gentle to her. And I knew that because I wanted to do that, I could do that. But you tell me in my book that power isn't my problem. You said lack of power. That was our dilemma. The fact that I wanted to do something didn't mean I could do it. It just meant I wanted to do it. I didn't have the power to do it. Had I known that the power of alcoholism was going to keep me from doing any of that, I'd have said you were crazy. I thought because I felt it and I thought it, I could do it. And we got married. The marriage wasn't much. We got married at the Candlelight Flower Shop on Congress Avenue in West Palm Beach, Florida. And it wasn't no big fancy deal. She started off bartering at $50 for the wedding. I got her down to about $20. She hummed, Here Comes the Bride, and Vaughn Got One Rose. So it wasn't no big fancy nuptials, I'll tell you that. I bought the rings at the farmer's market across the street. Must have been all right. I still got them. But anyhow, we left there, and we went over to her aunt's house. And I remember we walked in, and they gave me a glass of punch. They gave me a glass, and I took a sip of it, and it was punch. Hell, I hate punch. Only way to drink is if it's all full of vodka or something. But, you know, this had nothing in it but punch. And I spit it out and I left. I was mad. Grabbed my new wife and out the door I went. And I stopped at a liquor store. And we had an old Ford and I was driving it. And stopped at a liquor store and I got me a bottle and I began to drink. And she wouldn't drink with me and I wanted someone to celebrate with. So I picked up a guy on the side of the road. He was just a bum. He sat there. I said, here, we passed the bottle back and forth across my new bride. Same guy that wanted to be a good husband. And I woke up the next morning the same way I woke up the last time I drank. I woke up with a fear. I woke up in a mess. And I woke up with a woman crying next to me. Answer that phone, please. If it's for me, I ain't here. And I woke up with a woman lying next to me, and she was crying. And it wasn't tears just running out of her eyes. It was real deep down sobbing. And all of us have heard that sobbing, and we know how bad it hurts us inside. And I wanted to shut it off and to stop it, and I couldn't. And I talked to her, and I said, I'm sorry. And she told me that she was not going to live that way anymore. She'd lived that way before, and she wouldn't do it again. And then I took a vow. I told her that not only was I sorry, but I would never behave that way again. that if she would give me just one chance, I'd never do that again. And she gave me one chance. And she gave me that chance over and over and over again. And I continued to blow it. And I didn't want it to be that way. I wanted it to be better, and it couldn't, and it kept getting worse. I kept going to see. I'd be gone for 3 months or 4 months or 6 months, one time 13 months. And enough and everything runs together for me, because my drinking kept progressing and things kept getting worse. And, you know, I would write her letters, and they'd be long, lengthy love letters, and I'd tell her all this passion inside of me and the feelings that I felt. And by the time I'd get off the ship, she'd read them all, and I'd get off that ship, and I could see her look standing there at the end of the gate at the airport where she's waiting for me with the kids, and that she'd have that look in her eyes, that fire and that hope. And as soon as I'd get near enough to her where she could smell me, it went out as though I threw cold water on her, because I'd be drunk. And the thing would last just as long as it could, and I'd be back on another ship. I have no idea other than that she just kept hoping, and we stayed together. And things kept getting further and further apart. We had a child born of that marriage in 1968. I remember nothing at all about it. Not the conception, not the birth, nothing. But if you look at him today, we're twins at different ages. So I know that he is mine. I remember nothing about it. And alcoholism gave me that. 1973, I stopped drinking. June or so of 73, I stopped drinking for about a day. I remember nothing about it. My wife told me about it later. She said I'd stopped for a day, and I'd never told anyone. I just stopped, and she found me wandering around the neighborhood naked a block away. Brought me back home and got liquor in me. And that's all I know about not drinking until near the beginning of March in 1974. And on March the 7th of 1974, I found myself with my wife and kids in the car. I found myself at a man's back door 1,200 miles away from where we lived. And when I knocked on his door and he answered it, the first words out of my mouth were, "I think I have a problem drinking." I had never said that or thought that. I don't know where it came from. It just came out. Everybody at that point had talked to me about my drinking. She'd tell me she was leaving. They'd tell me they were firing me. A doctor say I was dying. Preachers tell me I was going to hell for my behavior. But I never said that. I never felt that. And out of nowhere, from inside of me, came the words, "I think I have a problem drinking." And the man took me by the hand and carried me back into his house, set me down in his study on a couch, and he gave me a copy of the book, Alcoholics Anonymous. And on the flyleaf, there were some words written in ink. It just said, "If you want what we have and are willing to go to any length, that God will provide." It was signed Love, Dad. My daddy had bought that book for me a number of years before in Alcoholics Anonymous because you had told him to buy it and to put it aside in case I might one day need it. And he wanted to interfere with my drinking. He would talk to you about what could he do. And you people were wise. You didn't talk to him about interfering. You told him to leave me alone. You said him, let him go where he's got to go and do what he's got to do. If you say something to him now, if you get in his way, you might ruin an opportunity later. If he doesn't want to do something, you can't force it to him. He'll treat it like every other advice you've ever given him. And I know the advice my daddy's given me over the years, and I know what I've done with it. When they'd lock me up again, and they'd say, "Please change," and I'd say, "Yeah, I will," and I'd blow it off. God, I'm glad he didn't do that with this life and death deal I got called alcoholism, or you'd have another speaker today. What my daddy did was carried me to the message when I asked for help. He didn't give me the message. He gave me the book, but he didn't give me the message. He said, "Come with me to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous." You see, he didn't have the answer. He knew where the answer was. That's on March the 7th, and I wouldn't go with him. I told him I was drunk, and he said, "That's right, you take anyone to their first meeting drunk." But I wouldn't go. So he wrote two numbers down on a piece of paper, and he said, "Put them in your pocket." He said, "And tomorrow," he said, "when you wake up, if you wake up, because you might die, but if you wake up, and if you would rather be sober than be drunk, call one of these numbers before you take a drink, and meet me, and we'll go to a meeting at 7 o'clock. The next morning I woke up, and I woke up like I always did by that time. I woke up in that same mess with that same fear. But there was something going on inside of me that was a little different. As bad as I wanted to drink, I didn't want to drink just a little bit more. And I didn't understand that. I just knew I didn't want to drink, and I wanted to drink. I look back at it now, and I know what that was. In our meeting rooms, we see it. It says the placards that are up there with our mottos. And the one that says, "But for the grace of God." And I think of what God's grace is. Grace comes from a Latin word that means gift. And God's unasked for gift to me. So you see, I hadn't said, "God help me." His unasked for gift to me that morning was that desire to drink, not drink, that was stronger than the desire to drink. The same desire that each and every alcoholic in this room who is not drinking has at this moment. A gift from God. And it was given to me with a responsibility that morning. A responsibility that I do everything to keep it or I'd lose it. Where did it come from? Why did it come? I don't know. Because they had a moment of silence in an AA meeting? I don't know. Because my mom prayed for me, or my sisters, or my wife, my dad? Don't know. Ain't important why. Important thing is it was there. There with that responsibility. All I could do the next day wasn't much when I woke up that morning. I went with my wife. She took me to, they told her what to do. She carried me to a hospital. And there they give shots. Now, it wasn't the stuff they give today for drying out. What they give then, they used to use a needle, as I remember, it was about that long. It was large, square, I think. And it was vitamin B12. And they gave it to you in the left cheek in the same spot every day. And they said if you had that for 2 weeks, you wouldn't have to drink for that 2 weeks. Now, they said it helped my nerves. I don't know if it did or not, but I didn't drink, and I got that every day. And God, I still hurt when I think about it. They told her, they got me to take vitamins, and they told her to give me honey and orange juice. Smitty had mentioned K-Rose syrup. Well, my wife didn't like me very much, and that's what she got instead of honey, with K-Rose syrup. Now, you mix up K-Rose syrup and orange juice in March in Cleveland. It's like road tar. There's some geologists here that can probably tell me the actual breakdown, but God knows it's like swallowing rocks. And I don't know if it helped or not, but I didn't have to drink. And then they said have candy. Every time he gets grouchy, stuff his mouth with candy. All the time. And she didn't like I said, so it was always sour candy. So please, if you're getting your husband or wife candy, make it sweet candy. That sour candy's rough on you. I don't know if it helped or didn't, but I didn't have to drink. And I met my dad that night. We went to a meeting. As we walked in, we come in the back door, and there's a guy standing there, and a guy in blue jeans and a shirt, and he stuck his hand out, and he shook my hand. My dad said, "That's Jimmy, and he's your sponsor." And my dad took off, and I got this yo-yo hanging onto my hand. And this guy squoze my hand, and he said, "My name's Jimmy, and I'm glad to meet you." And he gave me Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I can remember his hand today just like it was yesterday. It was firm, and it was warm, and it was dry. It was the hand of Alcoholics Anonymous and the hand of a newcomer. And I'll tell you what my hand was like, because I feel it every time I go to a meeting where there's newcomers at. My hand was cold, and it was wet, and it was scared. And then he did something nobody else had ever done. He began to talk to me, and as he talked to me, it was about himself. And no matter how many things we didn't have in common, we had everything in common. As he talked to me where drink took him and what happened when he tried to stop and what happened when he tried to cut back and when he tried to change this and how it kept getting worse and what happened in his family. And I knew he had lived exactly how I lived and behaved exactly how I behaved. And we had nothing at all in common, but we had everything in common. And the word identification was never mentioned, but it was sure as hell felt because I knew he'd lived like me. And then the meeting started, and some guy tells his story like I'm telling mine. And when it was over, he introduced me to the guys in that group, and he said, "This is Jay, the new guy." And these guys all shook my hand, and they'd all tell me stuff like, "Nobody ever got here by mistake. Keep coming, kid. You'll be all right." Never forget that. And then he asked me how I felt, and I told him. I told him I was sick and I was scared. And I didn't know what was wrong, and he laughed. He always laughed a lot, and it was a laughter of health. And he said, "Jay," he said, "I will promise you, if you'll do three things on a daily basis, you will never have to feel the way you feel ever again. Will you do them?" Hell yeah, I'd do them. I'd do anything. I didn't want to feel that way again. I didn't want to have to come off another drunk. And he said, "Number one," he said, "the first thing you do when you get up in the morning, you say, 'God, help me not take a drink today.' And then number two, if you can, you go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous." You see, in 1973, I got blackballed out of the Merchant Marine. He said eventually I might go back to sea. And if I went back to sea, there'd be many times I couldn't go to a meeting. If I didn't go to sea, I might be working somewhere else. But if I didn't have something else I had to do, not wanted to do, but had to do, I should go to a meeting, number two. He said, number three, he said, "When you go to bed at night, you say, 'Thank you, God, for a sober day.' Will you do it?" And I looked at him and said, "Jimmy, I can go to meetings, but I can't pray." Because by then, any relationship I had with a God was gone. The parochial upbringing that I had was no longer part of my life. I don't know what I believed in or didn't believe in. I'd made so many bargains and broke so many bargains. I didn't know what God was or God wasn't. But I couldn't pray to a God that I didn't believe. And I told him so. And he laughed once again. And he said, "Hell, you don't have to believe. Just say those words." And he was only paraphrasing what our book tells us. Our book doesn't say we have to believe. Our book says, on the other hand, if we believe or are even willing to believe, we're on our way. And all Jimmy was doing was establishing willingness. And I could repeat words that I didn't believe about something I didn't believe in, merely because I didn't want to have to come off another drunk. He took me home that night, and I remember the next day we were on our way to another meeting, and I didn't have a choice about meetings. He just said, "I'll pick you up," and he was there picking me up. And on the way to the meeting, he looked over at me and he said, "Jay," he said, "have you had a drink since last night?" The damnedest thing I've ever been asked in my life. He didn't drop me off until midnight. He called me at 6 in the morning. He called me at 10 in the morning. He called me at 2 in the afternoon. I'd been to the hospital for my shot of vitamin B12 in the left cheek. I couldn't have drank if I wanted to drink. But I didn't tell him that quite that way. I said, "No, of course not, Jimmy." He said, "By God, that's great." He said, "You know what? You have just now stayed sober the absolute longest period of time you will ever have to stay sober." I looked at that man like he's out of his head. The hell's he talking about? He said, "By God, one day." He said, "That's all we do it, one day." Well, that made it easy. And it took away every excuse I'd ever have to drink. You see, when Easy picked up, or stood up last night with 57 years, was I impressed? You damn right I was. But he didn't get it at 57 years. He got it one day, added up, 57 times 370, 365, plus however many leap years there are, hell of a lot. But it's one day at a time is the way we get this thing. That made it easy. See? Now I'm going to take you through the next 26 years and some months. But I'm going to tell you a little bit about it. 2 weeks sober, we're coming home from a meeting. I was to stay in Cleveland for almost 3 weeks, then go back to Florida where I lived. We're coming home from a meeting. I looked over at Jimmy and I told Jimmy, "I still don't believe in this God stuff y'all talk about." And Jimmy talked to me about Alcoholics Anonymous. He said, "Today was the first time you've done anything in AA other than sit there and drink the coffee. What was it?" And I said, "I read the traditions." He said, "Before you read the traditions, what did you say?" And I said, "I'm Jay and I'm an alcoholic." He said, "What does that mean?" And I told him what it meant to me. Because by then I had accepted the definition you had in the book. And I knew that when I took a drink, something happened. That I had no control. I knew I had that allergy. And as I told him that, he said, "I know you do." He said, "I just want to make sure you knew you did." He said, "Have you been doing what I told you to do every morning and every night?" And I said, "Yes, I have. I feel like a hypocrite at times, and at times I want to drink when I'm asking for help, not doing it. At times I'm not grateful when I'm saying thanks, but I'm doing it. I'm saying the words." He said, "Good, good." He said, "How long have you been doing it?" "Well, I don't remember tonight, but I remember then whether it was 13 days or 15 or 14. I knew how long it was. You can bet on that. It was a long time." And I told him. He said, "Fantastic." He said, "When was the last time that you've been this long without taking a drink, a day at a time?" And a feeling came over to me that I can only describe to you as an awareness of a power in my life that had allowed me not to take a drink when I wanted a drink. That power that I call God today. You see, it became personal to me that day because it did something personal for me. And it's been that way ever since. And it has gone from that into every realm of my life. So how did I get from there to here? I told you about the inventory and the steps. And just for a follow-up on that, a year and a half sober when I started on that inventory, 4 days later I was working step 9. So how long does it take to work the steps? I don't know. A year and a half and 4 days, I guess. I guess desperation is a real kicker there. If you got it, you want it, and you do it. If you don't, you talk about it. But anyhow, that's just me. What did I get as a result of it? I went back to sea, and I got very successful at it. I was the chief engineer on the biggest ship ever built in the United States under our flag. I had an injury in the early 80s that took me out of that profession where I can't pass a physical, go on a merchant ship anymore. So I taught school, and I was teaching college graduates advanced courses in marine engineering and how to pass the Coast Guard examinations. So I did well in that profession. Then I left that profession. I went into sales. And I did real well in sales. And I enjoyed it. And then I went into business for myself in the early 90s. And I've been in that ever since. And it's been all right. And I'm getting ready to make another change now. I'm just not sure what. But I'm starting to look around. Other areas of my life, things got great in. My mom and dad. My kids. My kids and I get along great. You know, they all tell me that they love me today. And they hug me and they kiss me. My little boy got married on July 15th in Torreon, Mexico. I went down there and enjoyed this gala event with his family that he married, and it's just fantastic. He runs a textile thing down there. He couldn't find any work here for it up here. They all moved away, I guess. Mother, kids, one of them lives in Alabama, one lives in North Georgia, and they love me, and I love them. And I got grandkids, and they love me. God almost don't want to tell you, I got a grandchild, 18, and says she's going to have a baby in October. I don't look that old. I sure as hell don't feel that old. But you gave me those relationships by allowing me to work the steps in my life. How'd things work out with my mom and dad? Well, my dad died in 81, and I didn't know if I'd ever made amends to him or not, because he's a very arrogant man. Even throughout his sobriety, he had a certain arrogance. He was a devout member of Alcoholics Anonymous, but there's a certain intellectual arrogance that never let me know if I was close to him or not. I never felt that warm stuff that I wanted to feel. And then on my 7th AA birthday, I got a card from him. He was living in not far from where John lives. He'd moved down there, and he had cancer, and he moved down there in December, and he was to die in March. But he moved down there thinking he would run away from cancer. It was in the latter stage, and it was just absolutely horrible. He wouldn't let any of us kids be near him or see him or talk to him while he was dying. So I never got to speak to my daddy again. And there, my AA birthday's coming, and I don't know how things are with him or if my amends are done or what. And I get this card, and I couldn't read it. It was just scribbles on it. But I could read Love, Dad. And then a letter fell out, and it was from my mom. And my mom talked about my dad, and she said that he loved me. And that he was trying to write to me on my AA birthday because he knew it was going to be my last birthday that he'd be around for. And he wanted to communicate with me. And she said he kept trying to write and couldn't do it. So she suggested that she write it and he copy it. And he tried that and it didn't work. So he cut it off with a card. Or she cut it off. She said, but I want you to hear what he wanted to say. He said, dear son, congratulations on your AA birthday. What a glorious and wonderful day. And how can we ever be grateful enough to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and for all that it's given us. For ultimately it's given us a loving God who's returned a lost son and rediscovered a lost father. And as I read that, I knew that everything was okay between me and Dad and God. And you see, that's what amends are all about. My mama, the same woman that prayed that the child in her would naturally abort or be a girl, because she didn't want another child like me. My mama died in February last year. But I started writing to her shortly after I started working the steps with John. And I began to write her a note once in a while, and then I began to call her on Sundays whenever I was in town. And I didn't know how to talk to her, and I didn't like her, and I didn't like being around her. But John told me I had to establish a relationship with her. Every time I heard the word relationship, I thought, man, going to bed with somebody. And I began to establish a relationship with her. I'd call her on the phone, and I'd say, hello, Mom. And that's as far as I could go that first day. And she said, hi, son, how are you? And I said, fine, I'll call you next week. And eventually this built to where I could ask her things, and I'd write them down so I could remember them, because they weren't important to me, but it was important that I remember so I could talk to her. And this went on until over the years I built up a relationship with her. And I truly loved my mother, and I liked my mother. And my mother loved me, and I didn't know how deeply. Till last year, she's getting ready to die, and she's up in Ohio, and she called me. I was living in Myrtle Beach, and she called and she said she I'd just been up, and my sister called and said told my wife, said Jay, Mom's about to die and she wants to see Jay one more time before she goes. And we flew on up there, and I walked in the room, and the nurses were in there, and my sisters were in there, and my kid brother was in there, and my mother was there. And God, she looked rough, and she just lit up like a jack-o'-lantern, just smiling. She told the nurse, that's my son, that's the son I told you about. It's a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I love my son. And you gave me that. See? You didn't tell me love my mother. You told me what you did to make things right with yours. And I was able to do that and make things right with her. And she died and we buried her. And my wife. I told you about the vows I'd made to her. I wanted to live by those vows and I didn't. I fell real short. My wife died on July 12th at 1:20 in the morning. We knew this was coming. She died of just old age in a young person. And she died of kidney failure. And it was just a horrible thing the way she died. And they offered her dialysis, and she said no, because it was a Band-Aid on a cut artery because of what was going on in her. It just wouldn't have helped. But anyhow, as she died, the last couple of weeks before she died, she lost a lot of control of things. And I didn't call nurses in or nurses' aides, but I was able to be there for her and to take care of her and to give her dignity and not have to have anyone else help out. I was able to be with my wife. I was able to be committed to her. You know, I couldn't change one of our children's diapers when they were small because it would make me throw up. None of that even crossed my mind as I took care of my wife.
the last words that came out of her mouth were, "I love you." And the last words I would say to her were, "I love you." A day and a half later, I was on a plane to Mexico for my son's wedding. She had wanted us to put that off. And as I'm there, I'm filling out an immigration form going into Mexico. It's 3 hours away on the plane. And I'm filling it out. And on there, I had my name and address and my passport number and all that information. They said, put down on there, marital status, single or married. And for the first time in over 34 years, I had to write down the word single. And I began to cry. And then I thought about Alcoholics Anonymous, and I thought about commitment, I thought about the vows. And I had obeyed and lived up to the vows in my marriage. And my marriage was finished. But my life isn't finished. You gave me the ability to fulfill those vows. You gave me the ability to be committed. Does that mean everybody got to do that? Hell no. I don't know what other people got to do. I'm sharing with you what happened to me. As a result of your showing me how to work the steps, I can stand here before you and say, yes, I am a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And God has worked in my life, and I've not only not had to drink, but I've been able to do what God wanted me to do. So how can I be grateful enough to this program of Alcoholics Anonymous for that and all the other things it's given me? I'll tell you how. AA was given to a couple of guys, and they wrote it down in a book, and they gave it to you, and they gave it to us, and all these others, and we were all given it with the very same responsibility. That we do nothing to change it, nothing to weaken it, nothing to water it down, nothing to make it better, but leave it just exactly the way it was when we got it. So there's a place for a guy like me to go that's got nowhere else to go. You will never know how grateful I am to you for my God and for Alcoholics Anonymous.